deity worship. So, once one devotee had gone for book distribution, he went to a shop, it's not in India, in the Western world, and the shop owner took the book and started to open the book. It was Krishna book, he saw all the speeches. Oh! He says, we don't worship forms. So, this devotee just pointed in the whole shop. There were big pictures of Hollywood stars and sports stars. He said, isn't that worship of form? So, ultimately, if you look at movie stars, it's a slightly outdated usage, but one word that is used to describe them is matinee idols. So again, the word that is coming is idol. So the idea is that we are all universally attracted to forms. And this attraction to form, what is to be done with it? If we are attracted to forms and the forms are temporary, then that causes misery. But at a simple level, when a child is, say, building sand castles on the beach and the tide rises, then the rising tide sweeps away the castle that the child has built. Now the sand has not been destroyed, but the form has been destroyed. And the child cries because of that. So the child is not crying for the destruction of the sand. The child is crying because of the destruction of the form which had been made using the sand. So the point is, we are all attracted to forms, and forms are temporary. And that attraction to temporary form causes illusion and causes entanglement. But Bhaktivinoda Thakur, in one of his classic books, Jaiva Dharma, has got a full chapter on deity worship. Jaiva Dharma is a fascinating book where it's philosophy conveyed in the form of a novel. So the idea of literature as fiction, and especially in the format of a novel, was introduced into India by the Western authors, and Indians became very attracted to that. So of course we had Ramayana and Mahabharata, and we had also say the story of Shakuntala and Bharat and others, which were in poetic format largely. But the idea of a novel was popularized in the pre-colonial times with the Britishers, and Bhaktivinoda Thakur used that to disseminate spiritual knowledge. So he has adopted the format of a novel in Jaiva Dharma. And in this book, he talks about a devotee, an intelligent Bengali of that times, who is on a spiritual search. And then he meets different spiritual teachers from different denominations. And then he ultimately meets a Vaishnava guru. And then that Vaishnava guru's instructions and the various discussions that are there of that Vaishnava guru with others, that is described. There is one chapter where Islamic Maulvi, a group of Islamic Maulvis, come to this Vaishnava guru, and then they have a discussion. So there the Vaishnava guru explains that, so this Maulvi says, you know, why do we need a form? Because the form is material, so why can't we just think of God? So the point that Bhaktivinoda Thakur conveys through this novel is, he says, even the thoughts are material. Even when we think about something, we are thinking using the mind. And the mind is a material object. It's not as gross as the subtle object, as the physical objects, but still it's an object. So we can't avoid matter. And there Bhaktivinoda Thakur makes the point that those religions in the world which do not have deity worship, they tend to be materialistic religions. Why is that? Because attraction to form is natural and universal. And when there is no transcendental form to which one can become attracted, then one stays attracted to material forms. So that's why we will see that those religions which are against the worship of deities, for example, Christianity and Islam, to a large extent, these are materialistic religions. Now, there are no doubt a good number of serious spiritual seekers, and there are a significant number of spiritual seers also in these traditions. But overall, if we see, both these religions, they consider material prosperity as the proof of their religious piety. That means, what is the proof that we are truly devoted to God? Oh, the fact that we are able to rule the world, that we are able to conquer so much land, we are able to get so much money. So now this is not really the definition of spiritual success. So why does this happen? Because there is no access to the transcendental. The point here is not to criticize any religion, but the point is to objectively understand the necessity of deity worship. So the infatuation with the material cannot be decreased if there is no transcendental form towards which the heart can be directed. Now, suppose a person who is living in a primitive economy, primitive culture, where there is only barter economy. This is exchange of goods, no currency. A person comes to a city, and on coming to a city, that person comes to know about currency. And unfortunately, the first currency that the person gets is a fake currency. So now, when this person gets the fake currency, the person has got some idea, oh, this currency is supposed to be valuable and I can get so many things with it. So by barter, many of the goods that this villager or rustic has got, he gives that and he gets the fake currency. And then when he tries to use that currency, he says, this is fake, it is of no use. Now, because of such an experience, later when that person gets a true currency, he says, this is also fake. So to recognize fake currency as fake is important, is necessary. But to reject true currency as fake, or to reject all currency as fake, that is not intelligent, that is unfortunate. So similarly, if we look at the example of currency, I'm giving to talk about form. So there are people, all of us, we are attracted towards forms. And we find that this attraction towards forms is disappointing. We are attracted to beautiful forms, but then how long does that beauty last? And people make various attempts to try to conceal the diminution of the beauty of the form. Nowadays, cosmetic industry is a huge industry. And the whole purpose is to try to preserve the beauty of the form. But it doesn't last for very long. So some people, when they understand all these forms are temporary, attraction to them causes entanglement. So let us go beyond form. And when they come to the form of the Lord also, they consider, oh, this form must also be like this. We have to go beyond this form. We have to go to some higher reality which is formless. Now, the form of the Lord is the true currency. Bilwa Mangal Thakur, in his Krishna Karanamrita, gives us a glimpse of the sweetness that is manifested in Krishna's form. Madhuram madhuram vapurasya vibho, madhuram madhuram vadanam madhuram madhugandhi mrudusmitam etadaho, madhuram 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 madhuram. So he is describing madhuram madhuram vapurasya vibho. Vibho, this infinite, vibho means great. This is the Supreme Lord who is infinite. And he has a vapu, he has a form. Now this itself is oxymoron. Oxymoron means when two opposite things, opposite ideas are brought together. Say if somebody says, oh, you are a courageous coward. How is it? Either you are courageous or you are a coward. Or somebody says, this is a
brilliant fool.
How can somebody be a brilliant fool? So, the point of usage is like, when two words in two opposite senses are brought together, that is called as an oxymoron. It's a figure of speech in English. And vapurasya vibho. Vibho means one who is unlimited. Vapu means form. Now, as soon as we talk about form, form means limited. So, how can the unlimited manifest in a limited form? So, now, if the unlimited is truly unlimited, the people, when they conceive God, often they conceive God in material terms. So, if God is big, then their idea is material bigness. Oh, it should be so big that you will not be able to see him also. He's so big, how can you see it? Now, Krishna displays that kind of bigness also in the Virata Rupa. When he displays that in the Vishwarupa Darshan in the 11th chapter, so Arjuna realizes that this is God, and he says, I have to offer obeisances. And then he says, Nama purastad prishtataste namostute sarvate eva sarva. So he says, I want to offer obeisances, but where do I offer obeisances? Now you are ahead also, you are behind also, you are to the right also, you are to the left also. So where do I offer obeisances? Namo namaste tu sahasra krutva punascha bhuyopi namo namaste. So he says, sahasra krutva, I offer obeisances thousands of times, and still that is not enough, so I offer obeisances more times also. So the point is, yes, Krishna is unlimited, but the unlimitedness of Krishna is not just that he is so big that we can't see him. The unlimitedness of Krishna is such that he can manifest in a limited seeming form and still stay unlimited. The unlimitedness of Krishna is that he can manifest in a small seeming form. And Krishna, as Arjuna's charioteer, as Partha Sarathi on the battlefield, he was just at one place on one chariot. But then in that same Krishna, when he told Arjuna that Divyam dadamite chakshu pashyame yogamaishwaram, in 11.8 he said, I will give you the divine eyes. And he gave it, and then suddenly that same Krishna who was manifested at one place within the chariot, which was on one place on the earth, which is one planet within the universe, Krishna manifested the whole universe. So he yaikastham jagat krishnam pravibhaktam anekadha apashyad deva devasya sharire pandavastada ihaikastham. So at one place Arjuna was situated, but he could see everything everywhere. Jagat krishnam, without any exception, he could see everything. So Krishna, his unlimitedness is that he although seems to manifest in a limited form, but he is not limited by the limited seeming form. He stays unlimited. So, what does Bilva Mangal Thakur say? He says, Vapurasya vibho. This Lord is infinite, but he has a form. And what is the nature of that form? Madhuram, madhuram. He says, so sweet. It is so sweet. It is irresistibly sweet. And to convey that, he gives the idea, he uses the word madhura, and he says it twice. Madhuram, madhuram. One madhura is not enough. So he says, twice I'll use it. And then he says, madhuram, madhuram, vadanam, madhuram. And he says, Krishna's whole form is sweet, but within that, his face is especially sweet. So madhuram, so for describing vadanam, for describing the face, he uses three times madhuram. Madhuram, madhuram, vadanam, madhuram. So he uses the word sweet. It's so sweet. Then he says, okay. You know, generally when a beautiful person is described, yes, we look at the form of the person, then look at the face of the person. And then within the face, the most expressive is the expression, is the smile or the frown or the whatever on the mouth. So he says Krishna's mouth is madugandhi mrudu smitametadaho. Madhuram, 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 madhuram. So here he uses the word madhuram four times. And actually, if you look at Krishna Karanamrit, it's in a particular poetic meter. So for that poetic meter, you have to have four lines in each text, and each text has to be of a particular length. So the mood of Bilva Mangal Thakur is that no number of madhuram is enough. This is Madhuram, 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 Madhuram. We can have ad infinitum, but then we won't have a poetry over there. So he goes for Madhuram and he stops over there. Madhuram, 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 Madhuram. So now the point he is making is that Krishna's smile is so irresistibly sweet that words are not enough to describe it. And he gives a metaphor. Madhugandhi mrudusmitametadaho. He says, mrudusmitam. It's a gentle smile. It's not that Krishna is loudly laughing. He's gently smiling. But that gentle smile is madhugandhi. Madhugandhi means it is like fragrant honey. Now, again, a literary critic might say this is a wrong metaphor. Because if you're talking about sweetness, and then you compare sweetness with honey, you should compare with the sweetness of honey. But why is Bilwa Mangal Thakur comparing with the fragrance of honey? Madhugandhi. So, he's comparing the sweetness of Krishna's smile with the fragrance of honey. Why not with the sweetness of honey? So the point is, buddhi grahya matendriyam. In the Bhagavad Gita, in the verses on Samadhi, which Krishna described in 6.20-23, he says that the perception of spiritual reality is atindriyam, is beyond the senses. So, it's when Bilwa Mangal Thakur is saying that Krishna's form is sweet. Now, that sweetness is not something which is tasted with the tongue. That sweetness is atindriyam, and he's experiencing it at the level of consciousness. So, to give us an inkling of that, now normally we all know that honey is sweet. But if some honey were also very fragrant, very aromatic, its charm would increase all the more. So, like that is giving us an inkling of Krishna's sweetness by comparing not just with the normal attribute of honey, that is sweetness, but its special attribute, that is fragrance. And he says, such is the sweetness of Krishna. So Krishna's sweetness is such that it supersedes all superlatives. Superlatives means good, better, best, excellent, high class. So whatever words we use, the words are inadequate. So in Lalita Madhav, which is a book written by Rupa Goswami, there the kings who have been rescued by Krishna from Jarasandha, they glorify Krishna. And they say that we composed choice verses to glorify you. And we thought that yes, we have glorified you wonderfully. But now, when we are actually beholding you, so we feel as if we have glorified the emperor of the whole world to be a landlord in a village. So the glorification is actually a minimization. So words are not enough to glorify Krishna. Now, still, words are the only tools available for the great Vaishnava saints who are experiencing Krishna to give us that experience. So that's why we have Rupa Goswami in his famous verse saying, when he's talking about the sweetness of the holy name, he says, I want thousands of tongues and millions of ears to taste the sweetness of Krishna as is manifested through his holy name. Now, there are people who are gluttons, who are very greedy and want to eat and eat and eat and eat. So, in the Egyptian tradition, there were some people called Epicureans. So, the Epicureans were rank materialists. They were very wealthy and they thought that eating was the primary source of enjoyment. So the problem with trying to enjoy through eating is our stomach's capacity is limited. So we eat food and then the stomach becomes full, you can't eat anything more. So they thought, no, we want to enjoy. So there were these very wealthy people, they got their physicians to make painless vomiting pills. And so they would eat food and after that, take the pill, vomit it all out. They would have one golden bowl for the food and one golden bowl for the vomit. And they would throw it away and then again eat it. And you know, so this is a person trying to say, oh, if only I had 2, 3, 5, 6 stomachs, then I would eat so much. But then this experiment was not very successful. In fact, it was a disaster. Because it's the point of eating is, the problem with eating a lot is not just that the stomach's capacity is limited, or not just that nowadays people will be worried, I'll become obese. But the problem is that just putting in so much food into the bodily machinery causes the body to break down. So that's why after that, one generation they tried this, and it just was a disaster. So many people died. So after that, there's an Egyptian saying which came up, which is there on one of the pyramids also. They say, no, you live on 1/4 of what you eat. On the remaining 3/4 lives your physician. So the point I'm making is that that sometimes people may have such a desire to enjoy, and they may think this is so enjoyable that they may want, I want more than one stomach to eat. But nowhere in the history of the world has any poet, you know, said that, oh, I want thousands of mouths and millions of ears. So this is meant to give us an experience, at least at a level of conceptual understanding, of how irresistibly sweet Krishna's form is. And this, as we become purified, this will become more and more apparent to us. So, Krishna's form, as is manifested in the deity, is the true currency. It is the way our innermost longing for beauty and love can be eternally fulfilled. Unfortunately, some people misunderstand Krishna's form to be material. So, if we see within the broad Vedic culture, there is broad, what is today called Hindu culture, there is the worship of deities, broadly speaking. But not all people worship the deity with the same understanding. So there are, I won't go into the technical Sanskrit over here. There are two kinds of symbolisms. There is ascending and descending symbolism. So some people say, yes, you know, God is all pervading. You can't see where is God. So therefore, you can envision God in a form. And then you worship that form by which you'll be able to access the infinite. And for that, they give the example, just like if we want to be patriotic. Now, if I want to say I love my country, the country is so big, what do you love? How do you express the love towards the country? So we may say, oh, there's a flag over here. The tricolor is there and I will salute the flag. So then that is the way we express respect for the country. So the flag is used to summon emotions of patriotism for the country. So some people say the deity is also like that. You know, to evoke emotions of bhakti for the infinite, there is a form. Now, is this a correct understanding? It sounds okay. It may sound impressive also to some people. But, suppose, say now India is becoming more and more of a developed country, trying to become. So, say, we say that now agriculture is not very important for us. So we don't need a tricolor. We'll remove the green from the flag. So we'll have bicolor then. Is it possible to change the Indian flag from tricolor to bicolor? No or yes? Yes, isn't it? You know, the Indian parliament passes a resolution. They make a constitutional amendment. It's possible to change. And maybe if it is changed, one or two generations later, people may not even know at one time India had a tricolor as a flag. So at that time, the same patriotism may be someone using a bicolor flag. So the point is here, between the tricolor flag and the nation India, there is no intrinsic connection. The connection between the tricolor flag and the country is simply in the conceptualization of the citizens. So this is the idea that comes when people conceive the deity simply as a representation for the infinite. They have the idea that there is no intrinsic connection between the infinite is formless, is unlimited, is transcendent, and whatever form you want, you can worship. So there are impersonalists who say, whichever devata you want to worship, you can worship. You know, you can make an image of Krishna, you can make an image of Durga, you can make an image of Shiva, you can make my image also. No problem. So the idea is that they think the form is just a tool to go beyond to the formless reality. Now the deity is not a representation of Krishna. The deity is a manifestation of Krishna. Deity is not a representation, just like a flag is a representation of the nation. But if we have a picture, if we have a picture of a person, then that picture is not simply a representation. Now, if say a husband carries the picture of his wife in his wallet, and one day he comes back home and his wife sees his wallet, there is a picture of some other woman over there. He says, "What is this?" "No, no, just the picture is different. I am thinking of you only." How is that possible? So there is an intrinsic connection between the picture and the person. The connection is not simply a matter of conceptualization. There is an intrinsic connection. So like that, the deity is not just... So when I talk about ascending symbolism and descending symbolism, ascending symbolism means that there is a formless concept like nation, and there is a concrete symbol, that is a flag. And the connection between them is just by our ascending imagination. Yes, I imagine this flag represents this country. But when there is a picture of a person, now there is the original person, and based on that, either a photo is clicked or a portrait is made. And then there is an intrinsic connection. So this is, the deity is an example of descending symbolism. There is an original person, Krishna, and that Krishna manifests as the deity. And that's why those people who are utterly detached from material things, even those people are attracted to Krishna. Atma Ramascha Munayo Nirgrantha Pyurukrame Kurvantyahaitukim Bhaktim Ittham Bhuta Guno Hari. This is one of the most important verses in the Srimad Bhagavatam. And in fact, it defines it actually in a verse, conveys the autobiography of Shukadev Goswami. Shukadev Goswami was Atma Ramascha Munayo. He was a sage who was Atma Ram, self-satisfied, was so detached that he just left home as soon as he was born. And Nirgrantha Pyurukrame, Nirgrantha had no attachments. But Urukrame, that Lord who performs wonderful activities, Kurvantyahetukim Bhaktim, he started performing bhakti towards that Lord. Ittham Bhuta Guno Hari. Such are the wonderful qualities of this transcendental Lord, of Lord Hari. So, going back to the example of fake currency and true currency, yes, there is fake currency, and that fake currency refers to the glamorization of temporarily good looking forms that is done, and that is undesirable. Even the conception that we can worship whichever form we want, that is also fake currency. But beyond that, there is a true currency, and that is Krishna's form, which is manifested as the deity. So, those who are attracted to Krishna's form, they are not attracted to things of this world, and they are not attracted to the forms of this world, and still, they are attracted to the form of Krishna. So, they reject the fake currency, but they don't reject all currency. They accept the true currency. And Krishna, he reveals himself, he makes himself accessible to us through the deity. Pillai Loka Acharya is one of the prominent acharyas in the Sri Sampradaya. And he gives an example to convey how the deity manifests the mercy of Ishvara. So he says that suppose there is a small child who wants to touch, who sees an elephant, who hears about an elephant and wants, "I want to touch the head of an elephant." Now the child is so small, the elephant is so big. How can that child touch the elephant's stuff? Can't. But if that elephant sits down and puts the head down, and then the child just touches the head, then the child can touch. In this way, the child's desire can be fulfilled. So he says, similarly, the soul is like the child. And Ishvara is infinite. Is like the elephant who is untouchable for us. But that Ishvara, by His mercy, that infinite becomes finite. The unlimited becomes limited. The omnipotent seems to become a motionless statue. Seems to. Does it actually become? Seems to become like a motionless statue. Why? So that the child soul can touch and serve and develop a relationship. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur, in his Jaiva Dharma, he concludes the chapter by saying that Krishna reciprocates with our desire. Ye thamam prapadyante tam sataiva bhajamyaham. So those who consider the deity to be stone, for them, the deity will remain as stone. That's what you want to see? Krishna says, that's what you will see. But beyond this, he says there are two levels. At the highest level, when a person is pure, when a person has realized Krishna, at that time, that such a person sees the deity as Krishna directly. But till that time, so most of us are neither here nor here. Now we accept in principle the deity is not stone, but still we can't really see the deity as Krishna right now. So what do we sadhakas do? He says, accept with the eyes of faith. With the eyes of faith, when we accept and act, then gradually we will realize. It's like if a child has got a cut, you know, say iron has cut. So at that time, there is a cut, and then the doctor says, I have to give you injection. He says, I have got a cut and you are giving me additional cut. What is this? He says, no, you have to accept on faith that this cut is for healing. This piercing is different. And it's not just a matter of just only blind faith. Because the child can, after taking the injection, experience the subsiding of the pain and the curing of the disease. So similarly, we may not have that understanding right now that Krishna is manifesting Himself as a deity. But if we accept on faith, the Krishna has the potency to manifest, and I don't understand, but I'll accept on faith. And we approach Krishna reverentially. We serve Krishna manifesting as a deity. Then He will reveal Himself to us. And gradually, we will come to this realization. Madhuram, madhuram, vapurasya vibho. His form is so unlimitedly sweet. So I'll summarize, and we can have question answers. So I started by talking about how the principle of attraction to form is universal. And in the normal life, it binds. And to become liberated, it has to be directed towards the spiritual realm. And the misunderstanding of deity worship can come because a person who has been cheated by fake currency may reject all currency as fake. Similarly, people who either because of attachment to material forms and the resulting entanglement, or who because of intellectual analysis, thinking that, oh, this is limited, how can God, unlimited God manifest? Because of that, they reject forms. Then they will end up, if based on this they reject all forms, then they become like people who reject all currency as fake currency. And beyond that, this is the misunderstanding, and the result of this misunderstanding is, as Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, those religions which reject deity worship, they stay materialistic. And unfortunately, we will see, even in India, India is a very religious country, but still there is a lot of materialism also. Why is that? Because people have not understood the transcendental form of Krishna. Because of the impersonalist predominance, so people don't get a higher taste even when they practice religious activities. And so they end up staying materialistic. The right understanding is of deity worship is that Krishna is so unlimited that He can manifest in a limited seeming form and still stay unlimited. And why does He manifest like this? To give us access to Himself. Just like an elephant may lower down to let a child touch its head. So this is Krishna's mercy. And the result of understanding Krishna's form, of Krishna's all attractiveness, is that we will get higher taste. And we will ourselves gradually experience how there is so much sweetness, transsensory sweetness in Krishna's form that it's beyond description by words. It makes us, as Rupa Goswami says, long for thousands of mouths to relish Krishna's sweetness. Such is the sweetness that we get access to by worshipping Krishna in his various manifestations in this world, especially the manifestation of the deity. Thank you very much. Are there any questions?
Haribol, thank you for the wonderful lecture. Okay, there are two types of devotees, personalist and impersonalist. Krishna says in 12th chapter, and regarding the impersonalist, Krishna says, Kleshodhyakarastesham avyakta sakta chetasam avyakta hi gatir dukam dehavadbhira apyade. So these impersonalists, they may be yogis or like that, and they take birth again and again, and these yogis once again become demigod worshippers, or they may take birth in Muslim, Christian families, not only Vaishnavas, but like any family. Now I may be born now worshipping Krishna now, and now my destination is now Krishna. So my question is, like, the personalists are the best, like according to you. That is my question. And my second question is, one question at a time.
Okay, we'll take that. So the question is that among the two kinds of transcendentalists, personalists and impersonalists, are personalists better? And what is the destination of the impersonalists? Is that also part of your question? Okay. So, yes, Krishna does say that when Arjuna asked this question in 12.1, Evam satata yukta ye bhaktastvam paryupasate ye chapyaksharam avyaktam tesham ke yoga vittamaha. So among those who worship the impersonal and the personal, who are better? So mayya vaishyamano ye mam nitya yukta upasate shraddhaya paryo petas te me yukta tamo mataha. In 12.2, immediately Krishna answers that those who worship me, and Prabhupada elaborates in his translation that in my personal form, Krishna is saying me means me. So it's Krishna. Those who worship him, and significantly Krishna is Shraddhaya Parayopetas. With Shraddha. With what kind of faith? Transcendental faith. Krishna talks about material faith in the 17th chapter. Faith in goodness, passion, ignorance. And based on that faith, different people may get attracted to different forms. But Krishna's form is transcendental. And those who understand the transcendental form of Krishna and worship him with transcendental faith, they are the most intimately united. Why? Because they have understood God in his highest manifestation. So those who consider God to be impersonal, their conception of the spiritual is reactionary. Their conception of spiritual is largely based on matter. They think, oh, matter is temporary, matter is entangling, therefore go beyond matter. Matter has form, therefore go beyond form. So they don't conceive of positive spiritual reality. They conceive of spiritual reality only in terms of the negation of the material, not in terms of revelation of the spiritual. Just like if, say, I've got arthritis in my body. And then, if say I've got arthritis in my hands, legs, so whatever movement I do, it causes me pain. And then if I decide, if only I could just give up all motion, then I'll be free from pain. Now it's true. If I could become free from motion, I'll become free from pain. But after becoming free from pain, I will want to do motion. Isn't it? So the cause of pain has been misdiagnosed. The cause of pain is not motion. The cause of pain is disease, arthritis. So if I understand that cause and treat that, then I will be able to be cured and be able to act in a way that doesn't cause any pain, but can help me to do constructive things and bring joy to me. So similarly, when people's conception of painlessness is largely a reaction to pain, oh, motion causes pain, give up motion. Like that, oh, form causes entanglement, give up form. So then their conception of spiritual as formless is reactionary, based on not a positive revelation of the spiritual, but on a negative rejection of the material. And, you know, if just becoming motionless is not possible, how long can we do it? That's why Krishna says immediately in 12.5, that klesho diktarastesha. Those who conceive of this absolute truth as impersonal, their progress is very difficult. It's filled with klesha. Krishna uses the word klesha twice over there to emphasize that point. So in contrast, so understanding that the attraction to form is not the problem, attraction to material form is the problem. Those who understand that and they redirect their attraction towards the personal form of Krishna, they actually become liberated joyfully, easily. So sukham kartum avyam, as Krishna says earlier in the Bhagavad Gita. So the impersonal is their destination, where they will depend on their conception of the spiritual, their conception of Krishna. If they just think, okay, there's an absolute truth which is impersonal and I want to attain that, and they try to live, they try to regulate their senses, they try to live a sattva-guni life. Krishna talks, describes them in the Bhagavad Gita itself, 12.3 and 4. He says that sanyamendriya gramam vinyamya sama buddhaya te prapnuvanti mameva sarvabhutahite rataha. Sanyamendriya gramam, they try to control their senses, they try to be equipoised towards all living beings, and then they try to attain Krishna. Such people will eventually attain him, he says. Bahunam janmanamante. After many lifetimes, they will attain him. Because gradually, they will attain Krishna, not as Krishna as Bhagwan, Krishna as his impersonal manifestation as Brahman. So this is those who reject currency and simply try to live on without any currency. You can live in some ways. But there are others. These are impersonalists who are called as Brahmavadis. And there are another category of impersonalists who are Mayavadis. And they not only consider the absolute truth to be impersonal, but they reject the form of the absolute truth as illusory. This is offensive. Why? Say, because there is one spiritual teacher, spiritual in double quotes. So he says, you know, you can take whichever form you want and meditate on the form. And concentrate and concentrate and concentrate on that form. And when will you know that you have attained samadhi? When by the power of your concentration, the form on which you are concentrating crumbles into powder. Oh, then you will go beyond form to the formless, and then you have attained samadhi. So now, unfortunately, or predictably you could say, many followers, they take a form, and when they are in a closed room, they just beat the form down and they say it has crumbled to powder. Now I have attained samadhi. This is very unfortunate. So those who offend Krishna's form, they are very unfortunate, and their destination is also correspondingly unfortunate. And many people in India, very few are actually inveterate Mayavadis. That means those who are offensive to Krishna's forms. Many people are actually impersonalists, in the sense of being Brahmavadi. They just think, oh, kuch jyoti hai, usme leen hona hai. There's some light into which we have to merge. Devotees have no urge to merge. They long to love and serve. And so depending on, we cannot brand anybody who talks about an impersonal conception as a Mayavadi and say that they are doomed. That is incorrect. But we also have to be cautious that we get a correct understanding and try to share that correct understanding about the absolute truth, about Krishna's form, with everyone. Thank you. Yeah. So the question here is, how can we know that when we offer bhoga to Krishna, he has eaten or not? Because we see plate is full, even and it is eaten only by devotees. Okay. Yes, it's a valid question. Krishna is bhavagrahi. So, when we offer bhoga, he takes the bhav in the bhoga. Now, again, if we are just going to stick to material vision, then the whole idea of deity worship, what to speak of putting a bhoga in front of the deity, even the idea of having a deity itself, we can reject. But if we understand the principle, is Krishna can manifest in a form to give us access. The point of Krishna manifesting in the deity form is to give us sensory access to transcendence, to help us to use our senses to connect with transcendental reality. It is not to manifest Krishna's potency or omnipotency. So when we understand this principle, Krishna is giving me an opportunity to serve. And then when we look at the principle of bhoga, of offering to Krishna, suppose, say there is one friend who goes to the house of another friend. And normally when, say, close families, one family goes to another family, they may take a tiffin, you know, with some sweets to give to that family as a gift. And then they go inside, they give that gift. And now, in any cultural family, if somebody gives you a box with some sweets, you don't give that box empty. You also give something in return. The dati pratigrahanati. So that family, the host family, takes those sweets and then fills that box with some other sweets. And then gives it back. And then the guest goes away. Now if somebody is watching from outside, and the same box went inside, same box came outside, what is the difference? But what was inside the box, that is the difference. So like that, when we offer bhoga to Krishna, what Krishna is interested in is the bhava. So the bhoga is like the box, and in the box contains the sweet. So like that, through the bhoga, we offer our bhakti to Krishna. And just as the box remains the same, but the sweet inside is different when the guest is coming out. So like that, when Krishna accepts the bhoga, then what comes back, when he accepts the bhava in the bhoga, what comes back is his krupa, is his mercy. So to the external vision, the food may remain the same. But to the spiritual, philosophically informed vision, there has been a reciprocation of bhakti and krupa. And how do we know this difference? At an intellectual level, if we understand the philosophy, we can know it. At an experiential level, if we take prasad, we will find that our heart will become purified. Our heart will become purified because we will experience a higher taste. And just by taking prasad also, you know, the lust, the anger, the greed, the anarthas in our heart will start decreasing. We will start experiencing purification that happens by the taking of prasad. So this way is an experiential way in which we can understand that prasad transforms. So philosophy, just like a child who doesn't know the value of a currency note. And the child says, this is just some paper just fallen down, let me tear it. Child says, oh, don't tear it. This is not a currency, this is a 1,000 rupee note. Or you can get 500 chocolates for your birthday with this. Really? I don't believe it. Then, if the child goes to a shop and gets 500 chocolates with that paper, and then they may remove the lid of a chocolate, maybe remove the wrapper of a chocolate, and the wrapper, if he gives back to the shopkeeper just throw it away. With that wrapper, one will not get anything. So like that, there is, first the child understands with intelligence, and then experiences actually when the child uses the currency. So like that, when we serve Krishna as the deity, then we will, first with philosophy we will understand, and with practice of bhakti, we will experience ourselves the difference. Thank you. Any other questions? Yeah, you have a question? We'll come back to you. Yes, Mataji?
Hello, in India, there are...
Worship is why? Because when we were small, when I was small, when we all are small, our parents always speak of stories of Lord Krishna or Shiva, you know, some great stories, and then we say to ourselves, wow, and then we automatically start worshipping those gods which our mother has kept it in the temple, you know. So this is the idea, oh, this particular, why not Shiva, why Ganesh, you know, we choose because certain stories we like of that person or god, we call it today, and then we put it in our temple because of the good, great stories about them, and then our parents say we should also become great like them. So I worship deity, meaning you know, form of that particular god.
Yeah, yes. So yeah, so many people worship the deity because that's how the cultural upbringing has been. We hear the stories and then we feel attracted to certain individuals and we start worshipping their images. Yes, that is the way in which many people do worship the deity, and it is good. We are fortunate if we are brought up in a culture where we learn about the Lord and his activities, and we start getting the inspiration to worship him. There is, for spirituality, there is the cultural aspect and there is also the philosophical aspect. So when we hear the stories, the pastimes, that may attract us. But then, if there is not adequate philosophical understanding, then when, as we grow older, we may think, are these stories really true? Maybe they are all imaginations. They are just mythology. Many doubts of different kinds may come up. And when those doubts come up, people often don't have answers. So then we may become skeptical. Or nowadays we live in a culture where skepticism may attack us. For example, there was this movie PK, which talked about how, which basically lampooned many religious rituals. And the whole idea is that people who are spiritually, philosophically uninformed, they will find it difficult to deal with the doubts which come from within or from without. So if we have cultural upbringing, that is wonderful. But along with that, we also need to get philosophical grounding. There is cultural upbringing. You know, a plant is there, we bring it up. Upbringing is there. But then, if the ground itself is not fertile, it is not well-tilled, the plant cannot grow for very long. So we need philosophical grounding to complement our cultural upbringing. So that philosophical upbringing, if we get proper philosophical grounding, if we get, then we get our questions answered. And then our faith becomes strong. So we don't just worship because it's my culture. Yes, it's good to worship because it's my culture. But more than that, we worship because it is the universal longing of the human heart. And that's why we will see in the Krishna consciousness movement, which Srila Prabhupada started, it is not just people who have come up in this culture who are worshipping the deity. Oh, there are devotees from various parts of the world and they had no cultural upbringing of any conception of Krishna, God in any form, and yet they have devoted themselves to the deity worship. Why is that? Because of the philosophical understanding. So for going beyond the insecurity that comes from a non-philosophical faith, and for going beyond the sectarianism that can come because this is just my culture, to understand the universality and the glory of bhakti, we can complement our cultural upbringing with philosophical understanding. And Srila Prabhupada started ISKCON on one side to offer the culture through deity worship, that is the Pancharatra Vidhi, and to also offer the philosophy through the system of education, that is the Bhagavata Vidhi. When both come together, then we can advance very steadily and smoothly and swiftly in our devotional life. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah.
From the society. So we learn, we children learn that we have to also curtail the evil from the society.
Correct.
So a way of life has been depicted by them. So even I follow that way.
Yes.
I remove the evil from the society.
Yes. Yes.
That's why, see, for instance, Lord Ganesha, he everybody likes him for one thing is his father said that Rome, just go around the world.
So your point is, we all know that story.
And he went around his parents.
Yeah.
So Lord Ganesh showed us that we have to worship our parents first. So we worship Ganesh also.
Yes. Yeah. So the point is that we worship the Lord because in the scriptures, in the stories that we get in the tradition, we see that moral values are taught, that we learn to overcome evil and cultivate good. Yes, definitely, values we do learn from scripture of how evil should be avoided, how good should be cultivated. In the scripture, there are two kinds of values. There are moral values and there are spiritual values. Moral values means we understand, okay, if I do this good, good will result. If I do this bad, bad will result. Those are very important. At the same time, spiritual values talk about not just being good in this world. They talk about a goal beyond this world. So our goal is not just to do good and get good. Because no matter how much good we do, the end in this life is not very pleasant. We all grow old, we all get diseased, we all die. And if we want eternal result, we need to go beyond just the moral conception of good and bad to a spiritual understanding of God as the supreme good and devotion to God as the supreme good. So, we practice bhakti not just because we want to overcome the bad and take the good. We want to go beyond this duality of good and bad to the transcendental. Because if we practice bhakti simply as a tool for establishing morality, there are many problems with that. First and foremost is that we may think that if people can be moral without bhakti, then what is the need for bhakti? Another problem is that we may think that if there are people who are supposedly religious but they are immoral, then the whole principle of bhakti is useless. Yes, that is possible, but there is the whole, this like, you know, even if you win the rat race, you still remain a rat. Isn't it? So even if we become very moral, but still, the Bhaktivinod Thakur has written a song where he talks about Bhulya Tomare Samsare Asiya. Now, how am I, dear Lord, I forgot you and I stayed in material existence. And now, if you look at the full song, it is a success story. You know, as I grew up a child, I studied very diligently, I got very good marks in my exam, I got a very good job, I traveled far and wide, I earned so much money, I took care of my family members, and yet he says, now I am old, it's all useless. You know, I wasted my life, bhulino tomare hari. So Bhaktivinod Thakur says that even a success story, if it is disconnected with God, it is a failure story. So it ultimately ends in failure. So I'm not minimizing the point that scripture teaches us good and bad. That is valuable. But beyond that, there is transcendence, which goes beyond good and bad. And we practice bhakti not just to become good, but to love God and to go beyond the good and bad of this world to an eternal world where our longing for love and happiness can be perennially fulfilled. Okay? Thank you. Yeah.
But because we are qualitatively similar to Krishna, we have some minute independence. So could you define the jurisdiction of this minute independence? Where can we exercise it? Where is our free will exercisable? And how is this consistent with Krishna's statement that he knows all of the future, which makes it deterministic?
That's a different question.
Okay.
One question.
Okay.
So the question is that we say we have free will. So if we have some free will, so what is the jurisdiction of our free will? And how can we exercise this free will properly? That's a related question. So now the jurisdiction is determined by our past karma. The Bhagavad Gita in the 13th chapter talks about kshetra and kshetragya. Kshetra is a field. So just as a poor farmer may have a small field and a wealthy landlord may have a huge field. So like that, all of us as souls have different levels of influence. So some people may have a very attractive, charismatic personality. And when they talk and when they conduct themselves, they are able to influence many other people. And some other people may have may not have such charisma. So they are not able to influence so many people. Why is this difference like that? That this itself is a example of how people have different jurisdictions for how they can exercise their free will. And so the jurisdiction that we get over which we can exercise our free will, that is determined by our past karma. So now, just like an ant, you know, its jurisdiction is very small. It can just move from here to there. An elephant, you know, when it has got a body which is so big that it can crush so many things under its feet also. It's a different body with a different kind of influence. So why does one soul have an ant's body, another soul have an elephant's body? That's based on past karma. So our kshetra essentially connotes our jurisdiction of influence. And that is determined by our karma. Now, the various spiritual paths, such as the path of karma or jnana or yoga, progress in those paths depends on how much control we have over our kshetra. Now, if I have a lot of intelligence and if I have a lot of control over my intellectual faculty, then I can do a lot of speculation and follow the path of jnana. If I have a lot of control over my body and I can perform austerities, then I can follow the path of yoga. But the glory of the path of bhakti is, you know, how much control we have doesn't matter. What we do with what control we have, that is what matters. So, you know, Hanuman, when he was building a bridge for Lord Ram, the Setu, he was able to carry giant boulders. The squirrel was carrying just some little grains. But Lord Ram accepted both their services, both of them. And both of them he blessed. So bhakti takes us direct beyond whatever influence we may have to what we do with that influence. So that's why as devotees, you know, we don't bother about how much control we have, what is the jurisdiction of our control. We focus on what is the direction in which we are utilizing the control. So if I have good singing ability, I use it for singing for Krishna. If I don't have good singing ability, that does not mean that I can't advance in bhakti. But still, I can express my bhakti in some other way and I can make spiritual advancement. That is the beauty of bhakti, that it does not depend on any material factors. So by learning to love Krishna in the association of devotees and then expressing our bhakti in whatever way is possible for us, we can best use our freedom and attain an eternal destination. Thank you. Yeah. We'll come back to you. You had a question? Yeah. We'll come back to you. You can speak loudly, I'll repeat the question. No, I will come back to you. You can just behind you. Okay.
Very small question. Okay, in India, there are Jagrut Devasthanams like Krishna, Vishnu, Ganpati, Shiva, like 12 Jyotirlingas.
So your question is, what is the understanding of Jagrut Devasthan?
So in India we worship main god like Krishna as well as these gods whom we consider as demigods. So what is your thinking about this? Because we in ISKCON don't consider these gods as important gods.
Okay, fine. So there are they are considered to be Jagrut Jaivasthans, where people go and worship, and they worship not just Krishna, but they may worship the devatas also. So, how is this to be understood? Yes, now this idea of Jagrut Devasthan is often coming from a material conception. That means, if I go and worship in a temple, and mostly people worship seeking some material things, and if those material desires get fulfilled, that means that deity is awake, is Jagrut. Otherwise the deity is Supta. That's what people think. So this is a broad conception of people's idea of Jagrut. That if my desires are fulfilled, and if many people say, oh, our desires were fulfilled when we went there, then they consider that as Jagrut. But when we go to a temple, the important thing is not whether the deity is Jagrut or not. The question is whether we are Jagrut or not. So, we come to Krishna not just so that we can get our material desires fulfilled. Yes, Krishna can fulfill those desires also. But the point is that there is the fulfilling of desires and there is the attaining of happiness. And we think that the two are the same, but they are not. If one desire is fulfilled, another desire will come up, a third desire will come up, fourth desire will come up. And fulfilling desires doesn't necessarily lead to happiness. So when we come and worship Krishna as the deity, we will become happy. Because our innermost longing for love will be fulfilled if we approach Krishna with bhakti. That's why when we come to the temples, we focus on trying to serve Krishna, trying to understand the philosophy by which we will become Jagrut. And that's the important thing as far as Jagruti is concerned. And secondly, as far as the devatas are concerned, yes, they can manifest through their deities also. Krishna has given the devata certain powers by which the powers which he has given are twofold. One is that they have jurisdiction over certain areas of cosmic administration. So for example, Shiva controls destruction and Ganesh controls the removal of obstacles. So Krishna has given them jurisdiction that way. Yo yo yam yam tanum bhakta shraddhaya architum icchati tasya tasya achalam shraddham tameva vidadhamyam sataya shraddhaya yuktas tasya aradhanam ihate labhate chitatah kaman mayaiva vihitan hitan. In 7.21 and 22 in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that whichever form someone wants to worship, I give faith to them in that form, and I give that devata the power to fulfill the desire also. So mayaiva vihitan hitan, I fulfill that desire. So yes, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, there is a story of Bharat Maharaj, where Bharat Maharaj is abducted by some bandits and they want to sacrifice him in front of a Kali worship, Kali deity, Kali image. And then Kali herself comes out of that and she says, how can you kill a devotee like this? She stops them. So the point is that even the devatas can manifest through their deities. So we understand the devatas are not supreme. That's why we don't make them the object of our devotion. But that does not mean that we should disrespect the devatas. They are respectable because they are empowered by Krishna. And to that extent, we definitely respect them. And it's possible that certain places may have certain temples of devatas or where desires may be fulfilled. And those deities may be called as Jagrut. In that sense, of fulfilling the desires. But we understand that we practice bhakti to make ourselves Jagrut. Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Yes, behind.
Hare Krishna Prabhuji. My question is basically about the actual understanding of the bead bag. See, Narottam Das Thakur used to call bead bag as the Jola Thakur. And even today also there are many spiritual masters, if you offer them obeisances along with the bead bag on your body, they don't appreciate it. They ask you to keep it aside and then offer that. And Krishna also says in 11th canto of the Bhagavatam that all the paraphernalia of my devotee is non-different from me. So the bead bag is actually to be understood or respected as the very form of the Lord, or is it an instrument to remember instantly remember the Lord?
Okay. So the bead bag, some devotees call it as Jhola Thakur. It is the place where the beads are kept. So what is the exact understanding of the bead bag? In the 11th canto, it is also said that all paraphernalia of Krishna is worshipable. Yes, everything connected with Krishna is sacred. At the same time, there are levels of sacredness. So one time, in the early days of our movement, Hayagriva Prabhu, who was an early disciple of Srila Prabhupada, he used to do typing and proofreading and editing of Prabhupada's books. So he was typing on a typewriter and Prabhupada came into the room. And so he wanted to offer obeisances. So he just started kicking the typewriter with his foot so that he could move aside and offer obeisances. Prabhupada said, "Hey, don't touch it with your foot. You know, you are Krishna is manifesting through this. You should respect it. It is sacred." So then he asked Prabhupada, "Do you mean that my leg is not sacred and the typewriter is sacred?" So Prabhupada replied, "Yes, you are a devotee, your leg is also sacred. But you know, there is a way in which sacred objects are dealt with. And to touch something with a leg is considered to be a sign of disrespect." So now, the point I'm making is there are levels of sacredness. So yes, even Bhakti, so just like Prabhupada said, the typewriter should be respected. So like that, Bhaktivinod Thakur had in the emblem of the Gaudiya Math, had printing press also. He called it the Brihat Mridanga. And he said it's sacred. But still, he did not put Brihat Mridanga on the altar and worship that. Isn't it? So there are, Brihat Mridanga also, the printing press is sacred, but it is not the object of worship. So like that, the bead bag is sacred and bead bag should be respected. But at the same time, it is not that the bead bag is directly Krishna. The bead bag contains the beads and the beads are what manifest the means by which we can connect with Krishna. In fact, not just the means, the bead bag is also, beads are also sacred because the spiritual master has chanted if we initiated and they are full see. So just like we have the deity and we have the dress of the deity. Now the dress of the deity is also sacred, that also has to be respected, but it's, we will be offering bhoga to the deity, not to the dress of the deity. So like that, we should respect the bead bag, but there should not be a paranoia or over-respect where we start becoming judgmental towards everyone else. Hey, you are not respecting the bead bag, you are not respecting the bead bag, you are not respecting the bead bag. So there has to be basic respect. So the bead bag should not touch the ground. And the bead bag should be kept in a clean and kept in a clean place. All that is important. But if there is also room in bhakti for individual devotional sentiment. So if I feel, yes, I should take care of the bead bag very much, and I will treat it as very respectable, very sacred. Yes, that is fine. But that is a matter of preference. When a matter of preference is presented as a matter of principle, then it becomes fanaticism. Now, yes, this is, I feel it very, very sacred. That's fine. So I remember once there was a question whether we can mark on the Bhagavatam or not. So there are two devotees. So one devotee said, "Bhagavatam is like Krishna. How can you mark on it?" So the devotees asked this to Radhanath Maharaj. So Maharaj said, "Yes, Bhagavatam is a deity. Bhagavatam is Krishna. And if you feel this is Krishna manifesting, no, you don't need to mark. But if somebody else feels, when I am studying the Bhagavatam, if I underline something, if I mark something, I can read it, I can recollect it, I can become more accessible, then that is like decorating the deity." So, if I feel jarred by marking on the Bhagavatam, I needn't mark. But I don't have to make that into a principle that I impose on others. And if somebody else feels, "No, I shouldn't mark on the Bhagavatam," then I don't have to impose, so you have to mark, otherwise how will you remember? No. So there is room for individuality, and the extent of respect that we may offer to the bead bag, that is something which is a matter of individual preference. Okay? Thank you. Yeah? Yes, Mataji. Yeah?
and on all the time, it is for you as a materialistic, as a material body. But if you keep the fan on for the deity also, so which means are you not bringing the deity to your level?
Okay.
And good offering question. The glasses like because of summer yeah. also. And the same the Chandan Yatra also. Okay. We do summer, we feel the heat.
Yeah, I understand.
So, so what is the question? What is the answer for this?
Yeah. So the question is that if we offer fan for the deity or we offer Chandan to the deity, thinking that the deity will be hot and we will cool it, then isn't this a material conception of the deity? Because we feel hot, we think that Krishna is hot also. So, is it a material conception? There's two important things which should not be confused. First is the conception of material and spiritual in terms of constitution. And there is the conception of material and spiritual in terms of application. In terms of constitution or composition, the Atma is Satchitananda. And the body is made up of Bhumira, Pona, Lavai, earth, water, fire, air. It is material. It's a clear difference. Now we may say that the deity, the pure devotee's body is spiritual. Now what does that mean? It is not that pure devotee's body is made of Satchitananda. But it is used, this is usage of spiritual in terms of application. You know, it is being used for a spiritual purpose, for serving Krishna. So, now, when Krishna manifests as the deity, Krishna himself is transcendental, but he has manifested at a material level. So, Satchitananda Krishna is manifesting through a deity which may be made of marble or such stone or other materials. So, the material conception of deity is to see the deity simply as stone. Yes, there is stone, but there is more. Just like currency is also paper. But there is more in it. It's not just ordinary paper. So, material conception of the deity is to see deity simply as matter and nothing more. Now, what does it mean to see the deity as more? To see the deity as Krishna himself who has manifested. Now, when we invite Krishna to manifest as the deity, the purpose is that we get an opportunity to serve him. So now, how do we serve him? By offering him everything the way we would offer to a respectable guest. So there are two moods. One is that a very, very beloved guest has come to our house. And the other is a king has come to our house. So there is opulent worship and there is intimate worship. Whichever way it is. Depending on the mood. But the principle is that it's not that just as we would offer affection and service to a person whom we respect or and love, similarly we offer respect to the deity. So it's not material conception to offer a fan to Krishna or to offer Chandan to Krishna, because actually if we had a material conception, we would think this is just stone. What is the need to do anything? Why offer a fan or offer offer Chandan? It's just stone. But it's because we don't have a material conception. It's because we understand that Krishna is manifesting over here. So our offering Krishna the fan or the Chandan is not because he needs it. But it is because we want to express our service to him. Naivatmanah prabhurayam nijalavapurno manam janadavidushah karuno vrnite yadyajjano bhagvate vidadhitamanam tachyatmane prithimukasya thamukhashri. So Prahlad Maharaj in the 7th canto 9th chapter while offering prayers to Narasimhadev says that, my dear Lord, you are purna, you are complete and you don't need anything from us. But when we offer you respect, when we offer you service, it is for our benefit because we become purified by offering that service. So now, if we say that Krishna is transcendental, then yes, Krishna is transcendental, but he has manifested here to give us opportunity to serve. If we just had a simplistic notion of God's transcendence, then we would say, what is the need for fan? Okay, there is no need for fan, there is no need for even food to be offered, there is no need for dress, there is no need for decorations, and then there is no need for deity also. So, that is the opposite extreme of the material conception. One material conception is to reduce the deity to only matter. The other extreme of the material conception is to conceive God as so transcendental that in no material way he can be served. So that also ends up alienating us from God. How can we connect with him? So the principle of deity worship is that we want to serve him. And whether it is offering chandan or offering or having fan, it is that we want to serve him in a way that is harmonious with the mood in which he is manifested, which is that as a guest or as a king whom we have an opportunity to serve. Okay, thank you. One last question. Yes. Oh, a lot of questions here. Okay. Yeah.
Satyanarayan Katha, which is quite famous in India, is this authentic, like from the scriptures?
Okay. Satyanarayan Katha, Satyanarayan Puja, is it authentic? See, there are, when we talk about authenticity, we can look at the origin, we can look at the content, we can look at the effect. So, or more of, in terms of form also. Now, at one level, we could say that Narayan is always Satya. Why do you have Satya Narayan? Is there some Mithya Narayan which is opposite to Satya? No. So, at that level itself, we don't need a prefix Satya. Narayan is Param Satya himself. So, now if we look at the specific stories and the specific modes in which this worship is done, at best, it is usually done in a mood of Karmakanda. Karmakanda means that, okay, I want to do this so that some material problems may be averted or some material good may come. And if it is done in a proper scriptural way, in terms of chanting of mantras, in terms of calling priests and doing worship properly, and there is basically to some extent, the much of what goes on in the name of religion is pious entertainment. I'm sorry to say this. Pious entertainment means many people really are not concerned with the content of what is done. They just want the form. Okay, something should go on. Kuch Bhagwan ka hona chahiye. Abhi wo Bhagwan hai ya nahi, wo Bhagwan ke sahi mein puja ho rahi ya nahi, people don't even know about it. So, often, when I said it's pious entertainment, for some people it is entertainment, for others it is cosmetic. You know, cosmetic, we are cosmetic to look good, so like that people do some religious rituals to look good. Oh, we are also religious people, you know, we also do something. So, that's why often this sort of worship is not done with proper philosophical understanding. So rather than saying that it is right or it is wrong, because it's an activity which is done by people and people have different levels of consciousness with which they are doing it. So in terms of the conception, we have to see individually. Rather than categorically rejecting it as wrong or fully accepting it as a right, if it is done in our family or if it is done in our acquaintances, our goal should be to try to elevate people towards a higher level of bhakti. So give them a proper understanding of how, of who the Lord is, how he is to be properly worshipped, and with what, how means, with what paraphernalia, in what forms, and with what mood. So rather than trying to make a judgment whether it is right or wrong, the emphasis should be to help people to come towards the right understanding. Does it answer your question? Thank you. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki, Gaura Bhakta Vrinda ki, Jai. So just, I have a website, thespiritualscientist.com, where I answer questions. So whatever questions are not answered over here, I'll answer them in the next few days on the spiritual